All right, welcome to Computer Science 50. This is the seminar on real-world PHP. First of all, unfortunately, this isn't going to be a really dazzling presentation because we're talking about things that we have to do in real life in order to not get hacked, in order to achieve the best possible performance. So this isn't going to help you achieve a spectacular iPhone app or a Facebook app or anything like that, but it's useful techniques that you must know when you do all those things. So think of it as a sort of prerequisite for creating any kind of web-based final project for CS50 or for any project that you undertake. So first of all, about the real world, what's so special about the real world? The first thing is, hopefully you'll have lots more users than simply your TF and maybe your advisor or somebody else. That might amount to thousands of users, millions of users, depending on how popular your website is. So first of all, that's one difference between programming in CS50 and programming for a bigger audience. There are more frequent requests, again, hopefully. You'll have more users hitting your servers all the time, constantly, those users will keep on hitting your server well into the night and constantly during the day as well. So there are also evil users who you probably don't want on the website but will come nevertheless, users who will input wrong data, incorrect data, trying to corrupt your data on purpose or to bring down your server entirely. So you have to deal with these users as well because they are a significant minority on the internet. So today's topics will include performance, security, and templating. If you have any questions, please do feel free to stop me, and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. Okay. So first, performance. How can we improve PHP performance? So you might have heard, or you might have written on the quiz itself, that PHP is slow. It's not like C, where everything is compiled and it just runs like that. PHP is interpreted. The PHP interpreter has to go through each line in your code every time that you run your scripts, and that leads to slow performance. And PHP itself, you know, is it really well written? People don't know. People ask questions about that. So PHP is known to be slow. But bearing in mind that many websites do use PHP, for example, Facebook uses PHP. If PHP was so slow that that it couldn't be used, then Facebook wouldn't use it, right? So there must be a reason why Facebook uses PHP, and there must be a reason why we can use PHP in our real programs. So first of all, how can we improve PHP performance? The first thing that you want to do is to remove unnecessary code. This is very basic, and you've probably done that in your own C programs and PHP programs that you've written so far in CS50, right? So what's a kind of unnecessary code that you might have in your program?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, you could be calculating things multiple times that you're going to do once.
Yeah. Right, so you could be calculating something that multiple times when you can just calculate it once and use it multiple times. So, for example, let's say you want the size of an array, and instead of just getting the size of the array and iterating through each of the elements in that array, you're calculating the size of the array every time you loop through that. That's a common bug or mistake that you make in C, and you can also make that in PHP as well. So that's a kind of unnecessary code. I noticed some students in CS50 were trying to connect to the MySQL server every time they had a query to make. That's also very bad because every time you make a connection, then that's a lot of overhead. So that's going to slow down your code a lot. So for example, if you had a PHP function that first connects to the database server and then makes a query and then returns that the results of that query, then that function, if you call that multiple times, then it's going to waste a lot of CPU cycles trying to connect to the MySQL server, right? So trying to factor out those kinds of heavyweight operations, if you only have to do it once, is a very good performance boost. You can also remove bottlenecks. We'll talk about what the main bottlenecks in web-based programming and PHP-based programming in particular are. And then we can also throw software at the problem. So most professional PHP websites, including Facebook, use such things as PHP Accelerator or Memcached. These are just two examples of software that can help increase the performance of your PHP code. But those are server-side things that the system administrators should handle. If you're writing your first big PHP web-based project, then there are other considerations that we have to take, and we'll cover those today. All right, so removing bottlenecks. So you know what a bottleneck is, right? It's the small part of a bottle. It's what makes the water go out slowly when you're trying to dip it backwards. And it's the same analogy with computers. It's the thing that slows everything down. So common bottlenecks in PHP code, there's disk. Disk is always slow. So if when you talk about computers, the fastest thing on the computer is the registers. The registers on the CPU. We talked about that in the last week of CS50. And that's pretty fast. Then there's the L1 cache, L2 cache. Those are the ones surrounding the CPU, and those are pretty fast too. And then there's RAM, which is slower, but still fast. And then there's disk, which is very slow. And then there's the network and the internet, which is very, very, very slow. Okay? So the farther you go from the CPU itself, the slower performance you get. So you can think of these outer layers as the bottlenecks in your program. And disk is one of them. It's very slow. It's pretty slow, so you want to avoid using it as much as possible. The PHP interpreter itself is a bottleneck because it's very interpreting a language is very slow, and it has to do that every time. And there are ways to prevent this. Network, as I said, is very slow, and the interwebs in particular are very slow because you're talking like worldwide servers. So to go from here to, say, Europe is very slow, okay, compared to like going from one CPU here to a disk right here. So there's a distance there. And MySQL is a bottleneck as well. Even though it may seem like a magical black box, it's just a C program. It just writes things to disk. And often it's located on a different server. So there's a disk bottleneck and there's the network bottleneck combined in MySQL. Except MySQL can sort of mitigate those by using clever algorithms that we probably wouldn't write for a simple web-based program. So how can we remove those bottlenecks? We can first optimize our code. That's the most important step, and you can't miss that out. You can't just throw software and hardware things. You have to optimize your code first. You can also cache requests to outside servers. We'll talk about how we do that. And also, most importantly, we can write better SQL. Optimize your SQL, create indexes that achieve much higher performance. Okay? Any questions here? All right, so the first bottleneck is disk. So here are two examples of PHP web programs that we might write. An online spell checker, think of it as you specify some text and it goes through and tells you which words are misspelled. So just like your speller.c, right? And then another program, a zip code table in a CSV file. And it goes through each of the entries and looks for your zip code and maybe tells you the population of your town. Okay, so that's just like problem set 8. How can we improve these two particular disk-bound operations? Because both of these read from disk, right? The spell checker reads from a words dictionary file, and the zip code table obviously reads from the CSV file. So how can we improve these two operations? Think about what you did for speller.c, and think about what you did for prompt set 8. Mm-hmm. You can load the data into memory. Specifically, what kind of data structure might we want to use?
Hash table.
Mm-hmm. Hash table, yeah, that's a good example. Or, you know, try or anything else, right? Pretty much any data structure will optimize your performance, right? Because you're not reading from the disk every time and doing a linear search through all the words. You're just doing it once and reading from that data structure, which will probably be faster. So that's just an example of how the skills that you learned in C can easily be transported into PHP. Because PHP is just a wrapper over C. It's basically the same thing. So you can't think that C and PHP are different things. They're the same thing. So the same skills apply to both. Okay. So that's a very simple example of a bottleneck. The next one is the PHP interpreter. So we talked about how PHP is interpreted and that the code has to be compiled every time that it's run. So PHP, you don't actually run GCC on PHP, but under the hood, PHP is actually compiling it, the code that it runs. So each time it runs, it compiles it into the code into bytecode, and it runs that instead. Okay. So, but the thing about the, PHP's code is that the code that you write rarely changes. Let's say you have 1,000 requests, and you change your code once during those 1,000 requests. That's 999 compilations wasted, right? Because you've compiled the code already, but PHP is compiling it again because it doesn't know that it's already compiled it. So there's one solution, which is templating, which we'll talk about later. That's not exactly a solution because it doesn't keep everything compiled, but it can help by compiling certain bits of your code, specifically the templates. And then we talked about the PHP accelerators, which is software installed on the server designed to keep those compiled bit snippets of PHP code around in memory. Okay. So that's the PHP interpreter. We can do more about the network bottleneck. So networks are slow, as I talked about, especially the internet. So this is the getting lolcat function that David showed in the last lecture. Can everyone see the code? Is it too small? Or okay. So what is the bottleneck in this function?
File get contents.
Mm-hmm. File get contents. So what does file get contents do?
Downloads from that URL.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So file get contents downloads a feed, an RSS feed, from that URL, feedproxy.google.com. Okay, so does everyone see how this is slow? Because it has to fetch the data from a external server, which is probably very far away. Yeah. So how can we optimize this function? Well, obviously, we can do something about file get contents because that's probably where most of the execution time is going. Okay, so what can we do? Does anyone have any suggestions? Cache it, yeah. So we can cache it. What does caching mean? Caching is basically retrieving some data and then storing it later. So you can think of it as a squirrel burying nuts for the winter. You can use it later, and it's much quicker than getting nuts from somewhere else because it's right there for you. Okay. So what can we do? It's actually pretty simple to cache. You can prevent your code from fetching the same data across the network every time. Using something like this. So I've defined some constants, the cache file, the file name, which is the file name of the cache that we'll use, the maximum cache time in seconds, 24 hours times 60 minutes times 60 seconds. So what am I doing here? If file mtime cache file, file mtime is the PHP function to get the last modified time of the file. So if the last modified time of the cache file is smaller than the current time, time is the function that gets the current time, minus the max cache time. So that's basically saying if the file was last written over 24 hours ago, then the cache is stale. It means that we need to retrieve the data afresh from the server. So we get go get lolcat, which is the function that David wrote in the previous slide. And then we file put contents is the opposite of file get contents, and it saves the file to disk. So file put contents, cache file, lol data. That's just saving lol data, which is the fresh data that we got from the server, to a cache file. Okay, so if the cache does not exist, or if it's old, then that's the first thing that's going to happen. But if the cache is new, if it was updated in the last 24 hours, then we can still get the we can get the data from the cache instead. Okay, so we say lol data equals file get contents cache file. So instead of retrieving the data from the network, from the internet, we retrieve the data from our local disk cache. Okay, so because disk is faster than network, this will result in faster performance, at least for all the requests that aren't in the 24-hour interval. Okay, does that make sense? Yeah. So if you're thinking of screen scraping, for example, if you're thinking of getting some data from an external website, then and that website's data doesn't change very frequently. For example, if it only changes every 5 minutes, then you certainly want to do caching. Because even if 5 minutes seems like a very short period of time, that's still a lot of, you could still get millions of requests during those 5 minutes that you're not caching. Okay, so you're going to save yourself a lot of bandwidth and a lot of time wasted waiting by caching. Okay, so this is actually what we did for the Google News. This is actually, I wrote a very simple PHP cache function, very similar to this, for Google News. And while it seemed like you were accessing news.google.com, you were actually accessing our own server. And I was I was managing the cache, which kept all the zip codes and all the news. So your news might have been a little stale. Did anyone notice that? That's the drawback if you cache things. Sometimes, for example, Google News updates very frequently, every minute or so. So if we're caching for every 24 hours, then you're going to get a lot of old news. But if no one noticed, then it succeeded. And the reason why I did that was because Google actually blocks anyone who calls the Google News service too many times. And you might run into that in your own final projects. So it's not only Google. Many web providers of RSS feeds and other feeds like that will block you if you try to make too many requests. So always do caching. Okay. Any questions about caching? No? All right. The presentation will be up online, so you don't need to copy it down if you don't have time. Okay, so MySQL is also a bottleneck. So what are two common errors in MySQL? We can fetch too much data. We've all seen lots of SQL queries so far, and we've seen the select query. The select query gets data from the server. So I say too many columns, select star from students. Why is this too many columns? Let's say I'm just trying to get the names of each student in the class, and I say select star from students. Why is that bad? Right, yeah. All I need is the name. I don't need everything else. So by selecting select star is all the columns, right? So I don't need to get all the columns. I can just get the usernames. I mean, the names. Why am I getting all the columns? So it actually costs a lot of resources to transport data from MySQL and back to your PHP code. So by selecting all the columns and getting all the data associated with those columns, you're actually wasting a lot of resources by trying to do that. Okay? So always just get the columns that you want. Not star. Star should be avoided when possible. Okay? All right, so too many rows. What's wrong with this second column? Select star from students where student username equals J Harvard. Is anything wrong with this code? No? Nothing wrong with this? Despite the fact that it says too many rows? Why is it too many rows? Why could it be too many rows, depending on your database schema?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you probably only want one because there's only one student with the username jharvard, or so we hope, right? Well, usernames should be unique. So by saying select star from students where student username equals jharvard, we might be looking for more things than we actually want. So in every case, we only want zero or one entries, right? We only want, if the query fails, we want zero entries. So jharvard doesn't exist, then we want zero rows returned. If jharvard does exist, then we want one row returned. But in this case, MySQL goes merrily on its way looking for jharvard, and it goes down the table, maybe doing a linear search if you haven't optimized it with indices, which we'll cover in the next slide. So it'll go through the table looking for jharvard, and once it's found the first one, it'll say, okay, I got one jharvard, and then it'll go looking for another jharvard until it reaches the end of the table when it says, oh, okay, I only found one jharvard. But of course you only found one jharvard. It's unique. So that's the that's a problem with this SQL statement because you're trying to get more than you actually have. So how can we improve this query? Mm-hmm. So we can say select star from students where student username equals jharvard, limit one. And that limits the number of entries that will return. So what that does is you can think of MySQL as doing a while loop through the entire table. And when it says, if student username equals jharvard, then return found, and then break out of the loop, okay? So it's going to find the first one, and then it's going to say, okay, I found my first entry. I found one entry. I'm going to exit now, okay? So you can use limit in that way. So limit one. You can also limit it to returning. For example, if you want the 30th row to the 60th row, you can say limit 30, and that'll return 30 rows from row 30. Okay? Well, that'll be the 30th row counting from zero. Yeah? Any questions about this? About getting too many columns and too many rows? It's a very effective way to optimize your code, because if you have any of these, then it'll run faster. No? Okay. Another bottleneck was not having indexes. So can anyone tell me what an index is in MySQL or in any database?
It's just where you set a certain column to be, like it's organized according to that.
So mm-hmm. Yeah, So it's basically when you have a column or multiple columns, you can select them to be indexes of the table. So it's like an index in a book, where instead of looking through each of the pages in a linear search, you might just go to the index and then look for the appropriate point in the index and then go to that page. Okay, so it's just a very nice way of making MySQL making MySQL's job easier, looking for things. Okay, so how would we use indexes? Well, first of all, there are four types of indexes. There's the primary key, which we've all used, right, in problem set 7 and 8. So that's when you want to say that something is unique. For example, a student username might be unique, and so it might be called primary key. A student ID is probably also unique. A zip code is unique. So all of those unique kind of things which you want to search by are prime candidates for primary key. Then there's also unique. Unique is similar to primary key. What it does is that it makes sure that everything in that index is unique. So you use it when you're not trying to say that it's the main index that you'll search by, but it should be unique. Okay. So think of it as a primary key without steroids. Okay. So that's unique. Then there's also the index index, which is a simple index where things don't have to be unique. It's just an index. Think just like a regular book index. Okay. So you can use it when some rows are the same. You can use it in any case with index. It presents no constraints like unique and primary key. And full text. Full text is the full text indexing. You might want to use it if you're trying to index some body text in your code. For example, if you have, I don't know, if you have a bunch of web pages that you're trying to describe, and each of those descriptions you want to search by, then you might want a full text index on those body texts. But you can only do that with the MyISAM database engine, not the InnoDB database engine that we used for transactions in problem set 7. Okay? So that's that. If you want any more details on each of the indexes, then the MySQL server manual is the place to go, dev.mysql.com. So what indexes to create? Which columns do we want to create indexes on? That's a very important question, because while indexes are very nice when you're searching, it's actually very expensive to create an index. So if you have for example, if you've imported the entire Wikipedia database, then you might, with the English Wikipedia, then you might end up with 5 million page titles in your database table. And I did that in my final project, and it was very slow generating the index for that table. So you only want to create the indexes that you want. So what are the correct indexes to make? Can anyone tell me? So basically things that you're going to look up by. So if you're not going to look up by, say, the, I don't know. So if you're only going to use the page title and you're not going to use the page ID, then you only want to create an index for page title, because you're going to waste time trying to create an index for page ID. And an index is a huge chunk of disk space as well. Okay. So that's the kind of index that you want to make. If you're always going to be searching by two columns, for example, if you're going to say, if this student's name is such and such, and if their birthday is such and such, then you might want to create an index that spans both of those columns. So you might want to create an index on both username and birthday combined. And you can do that in PHP MyAdmin using the index tool, or rather it's not such a tool, but let's say, okay, so let's say we have these, oops, I have to go to structure, and then details. If we want to create an index on two columns, then we can say create an index on two columns, and then we can specify two columns that we want to create an index on. Let's say we're always searching by name and email, or we're sometimes searching for name and email. Then we can say username and user email are the two fields to search by or to create an index on. And then we can select an index name and email maybe, and then index type. What might be a good index type for searching by name and email?
Primary?
Sure, but I also have a user ID that I'm using. So you can't have more than one primary key. So what might be a good one?
An index?
Yeah. A unique index? Yeah. So we probably want to use a unique index. That's because name and email are, well, email is unique. But there is one problem. The thing about strings in indexes is that they're truncated. So if you say, so that's the reason behind this size column. If we want to say, so we have to say how many characters of each column we're going to use for our index. So for example, if I say I want 5 characters from name and 5 characters from email, that's going to say that might create an index like, so for example, if the name is Dark Helmet and the email is darkhelmet@google.com, then the index might be D-A-R-K, dark h, right? Because it's going to take the first five characters from Dark Helmet, the name, and the first 5 characters from darkhelmet@google.com. And combined, those will be dark h. And so if you had a second person called, I don't know, dark hamster, darkhamster@google.com, then those two users will end up with the same index. So you have to be careful about indexes and the fact that they truncate those strings to create them. So we might want to create an index in this case. So a unique key is not faster. A unique key is going to say that there are constraints when you insert data and when you update the data. So in this case, you can use a simple index, and and it'll still help you optimize the searches on name and email. Okay. So that's creating an index. So how can we actually see if our indexes are working? So I wrote here, make MySQL explain itself. Why explain is in big caps is because explain is actually a SQL statement for MySQL, and it can make MySQL explain itself when it does something. So let's say I actually have two tables here that you've seen, have index and no index. They're both the same structure. The only difference being have index has an index, and that index is a primary key on user ID, and username index, that's an index name on username. So you can deduce that we're searching by user ID sometimes, and we're sometimes searching by username. Okay, so those are the two indexes on. Have index, and no index is the same structure, but no index. Okay? So no indexes, so it has nothing to search by, just linear search. Okay, so we can see whether MySQL is actually using this index. Let's go to no index. This is, remember, the table without the indexes. So we can say SQL, select star from no index, where let's search by username, where username equals David J. Malin. Okay, so this is our SQL query, very simple. It's just selecting by name, and when I click go, it works. We can actually, if we go back and then put the word explain in front of select, so explain select star from something such and such, and then hit go. You see here that we haven't actually got the data back, but we've got this cryptic table row back. It says, so the select type is simple. That just says that we're doing a simple select. But you can see here that we're going through three rows. So three rows might have matched. And three here refers to the fact that there are three rows in the table. So it's saying that three rows in the table might have matched this particular query. So David J. Malin could have been any of the three rows in the table. So what it's done is it's done a linear search of each of those rows. And while it's really fast, while it's only 0.003 seconds or so on that small three row table, if that becomes 5 million rows, then that's really slow going through each entry doing a linear search. You can think of it as Ken's dictionary implementation right at the bottom of the big board. Although he didn't do a linear search, he did an interesting hash table. So you can see here that MySQL says key null, so that means it didn't use a key, and didn't use an index in this case. So that's no index. Remember that. And then we can go to our have index table, which remember is the same structure but with two indexes, and then we can execute the same explain query, explain select from have index, and then hit go. And then here, it's a bit different. It says, it's still a simple select query, but it says possible keys, username index. So it's gone through each of the keys in the table and said, oh, maybe I can use username index as the key to use. So maybe I can do a faster query than simply doing a linear search. And then, sure enough, it says rows 1. So it means that only one row in the index matched David J. Malin. So it knew that it only had to go through one row. And voila, it will return the same result. So can you see how it's how the index helped reduce the number of rows that it had to look through from 3 to 1? And that it's also the same if you have 5 million rows and you had the same database schema, then it would have the same effect. It would reduce looking through 5 million rows to just looking through one row. Okay, so it's really effective, and it will confer speed benefits to your database in no time. So index is very important. Got it? Good? Any questions about indexes? No? Okay. Moving right on. So that's it for performance, actually. Does anyone have any questions about performance and how you might improve the performance of your programs, of your web-based programs? Is anyone at the point where you're thinking about those implications? Yeah? So do you have any, are there any things that you've worked on in your program to help that kind of performance?
Not really.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, there are lots more besides this that you can do, but these are very simple techniques that will increase the speed of your programs by several folds. And the indexes thing, I can only reiterate that it's very important, especially when you have large data sets. Okay, so we're going to cover performance in the next half. So we'll take a tape break here, and we'll be back with performance. All right, so security, that's very important. As I said at the very beginning, there are many evil users out there who are spending countless hours on Friday nights and Saturday night trying to break your web application. So you have to make sure that all the possible vulnerabilities in your code are patched before you release it to the real world. So the first potential exploit is SQL injection. You've all heard of that in class, and hopefully you've implemented some techniques to prevent that in your problem sets that use databases. There's also cross-site scripting, which I may have been covered in class. Has it been? No? Okay, so that's very important, and it's something that many people miss. And then there's also invalid values. So good input validation is also extremely important when creating your own web-based programs. Okay, so what is SQL injection? So first we have this very simple example. Username is we get from $getUsername. And then SQL, we create a SQL statement, sprintf select star from students where username equals such and such, and the such and such is $username. So what is wrong with this code? Yeah, escape. So we've forgotten to escape username. So why is this bad? So let's take one example of a particular input that a user could give. So what if the user types in Robert? Is that going to be a problem? No, because the SQL query is simply going to be select star from students where username equals Robert, right? That's not a problem. But what if the user types in Robert, semicolon, drop table students, and then semicolon, and then hyphen hyphen, which means a comment in MySQL, so the rest of the line is ignored. What happens when the user types that in? Yeah, it deletes the table. That's because the SQL statement is going to be select star from students where username equals Robert, drop table students. So you can concatenate multiple SQL queries using a semicolon. And that's basically two statements. One saying, OK, get Robert from the table, which is probably going to be meaningless now that we've deleted the table in the second statement, drop table students. And then the rest of that quote and semicolon were ignored with the comment syntax. Okay. Yeah.
Also, would that specific stack actually work in PHP? Because doesn't MySQL query only allow a single query?
Does it?
I'm looking at the page right now.
I've seen conflicting uses of MySQL query that allowed multiple. Oh, okay. Okay, so so PHP, I guess is that MySQL query?
Yeah.
Okay, so MySQL query does not support multiple queries in one MySQL query function call, so that wouldn't work. Oh, what about the MySQL improved extension?
It might.
I don't know. Not all of you are going to be using PHP, and it's certainly bad to have. Besides having multiple statements like this, there are also other ways of exploiting this. You could get where username. So, for example, let's go back to your problem set 7, where you were logging users in by saying select something from users where where username equals something and password equals something. And if their username and password matched, you let the user in, right? Because you returned one row. But what if the user types in something that resulted in select star from users where username equals something and password equals that wouldn't work. I'm thinking so. There's a so when you say something equals one. And one is always true, right? So if you had an OR statement, then that could be exploited because that would always return true and say that the user always existed. It's very, very depending on the SQL query that's actually being used. So a SQL injection is very hard to engineer because you have to know you can guess the database schema and try to create an exploit around it. So if you're trying to hack a website, then you need to think about the database schema. And so if you're trying to not be hacked, then you also have to think about SQL injection and escaping the statements that come in through the web. Okay? And that was really easy, right? MySQL real escape string can escape your strings that you input that are inputted. Okay, so I saw some of you sniggering. This actually comes from this XKCD comic, and that was on the problem set, or something I recall, but it's just a comic that's it's epic actually, because it just shows a SQL injection. All right, so everyone done? Another example of a security problem is XSS, cross-site scripting. We have two files, register.php and listusers.php. Let's say we have a database backend that stores each of these users in a database table. So in register.php, we get the username, $_get_username. And let's say we have a magical function that just stores the username in the database, store username in database username. So that's simple. There's no problem there, assuming that we've escaped our input, of course. And in listusers.php, let's say this is a forum. We're developing a forum, and we want to list all the usernames that are registered on the forum. Okay? Sounds like a plausible example, right? And then we say for each user as user, it's just pseudocode saying that for each user that's in the database, then let's print out their name. Okay? So what's a potential gotcha here? Remember, we've escaped everything, so there's no database problem. But we've forgotten. Yeah?
HTML injection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have the user, instead of injecting SQL, can inject HTML, arbitrary HTML. And because we've forgotten to do one crucial thing, they are going to be able to do anything to the cookies on our website, any other variables that are in JavaScript. Basically, they can steal stuff from us. Because if the user types in, for example, let's say this is their username. It's alert pwned. Send user cookies to bad site. Let's say that's a magical function that they wrote somewhere else. Obviously, you'd have to include the function in here. But you can see how you can insert arbitrary XHTML and, by extension, arbitrary JavaScript. And JavaScript can do nasty things if it can run on your own web page. So you can actually access the cookies that are on a, that are registered on a particular website by saying document.cookies. So by so for example, if on the forum, if a username had this as their username, and this function contained functionality that read document.cookies and then sent them to an external bad site. And you can't use AJAX here, but you can run a GET query on any particular website by, say, reading in an image with the particular GET URL. It looks like an image, but it's actually just sending data to the bad site. So this is a way in which they can steal your cookies and therefore your login information and then send that to a bad site. And then the bad site, in turn, could just log themselves in as you and then do nasty things with their account. Okay? So that's called a cross-site scripting, XSS, vulnerability, and it's actually very prevalent. It's prevalent in... So these sites, since 1990, have had XSS vulnerabilities. Most of your major websites have had these bugs, and they probably still do today. Okay? So that's one thing that's very... people have forgotten to say to deal with this particular bug. So the question is, how do we deal with this bug? So what can we do? Instead of saying echo username, what should we do? So in particular, what do we want to do to this string that will make it less harmful, that will make it not harmful? This string is harmful right now because this is a it's a angle brackets. Yep. So MySQL real escape string made a string harmless by putting a backslash in front of every single quote. What can we do with this string to make it harmless, to make it non XHTML?
HTML entities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, HTML entities. So HTML entities is a function that's specifically made for this kind of functionality, which when called will replace each of these special XHTML characters with their their HTML entity equivalent. So for example, this will be replaced with and LT semicolon, which means less than, and this will be replaced with and GT semicolon, which is the HTML way of saying a close angle bracket. Okay. So what HTML special calls will do to the string is it will simply neuter it and make it into a simple string that will cause no harm. Okay. And it's the same technique that you might have used, or hopefully you did use, with problem set 8 when you generated that XML page and you had to do HTML special calls on the link and the title of the articles that you generated, right? So did everyone do it? Yeah? So it's the same thing here, except a slightly different use. Okay. So when you're trying to print something out from the database and you haven't actually validated that data to make sure that it doesn't have any XHTML, do make sure to call HTML entities or HTML special jars on that string before you print it out, okay? And then you'll avoid becoming like the thousands of websites that have been hacked. Okay, so security example 3. This is a another example. Recall problem set 7 where we were trying to read in the number of shares and then we were buying that kind of that particular stock in our database. So num shares equals MySQL real escape string. We're good programmers. We've managed to escape the string. So $_get_shares, and then we've generated a SQL statement. But what is the problem here?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we want shares to be a positive integer, but we haven't checked, right? So how can we check? There are multiple ways of doing this. Preg match, yeah. Preg match is the Perl regular expression matcher function in PHP. Yep. And so you might want to combine it, combine multiple checks. For example, there's the is_numeric function. Let me list the functions that we can use. So regular expression we talked about with preg match. Ereg is also a regular expression matcher in PHP, but it's very slow, and I hear it's been disabled in the next version of PHP. IsNumeric is the is a function that checks to see if a string is a numeric string. So since everything in $_get is always a string, it's never an integer or a float or anything, right? It's always a string because it's coming in from the web browser. is numeric, we'll check to see if dollar underscore gets shares is a numeric string. Okay. You don't want to use is int because it'll always say false, because it's always a string, but the difference is between a numeric string and a non-numeric string. So is numeric. Obviously, that won't check to see if the number of shares is zero or negative, but you can combine that with a check for zero or negative. Okay? Yep. Right. PHP doesn't really distinguish between data types, but it actually does. So with the isInt and isFloat and all those data type-related functions in PHP, it actually does distinguish between data types. Yeah. So PHP is sort of inconsistent in that manner. Yeah.
So if you were to accept like user input to specify a file on your file system, mm-hmm. would there be a way of escaping special file characters?
Yeah. So if you are accepting file names that exist on your system, then there are ways to neuter that string so that it doesn't go outside your outside the particular folder, the directory that you want it to access. I forget the function names offhand, but there are functions that will make sure that you only look inside a particular. So for example, you can get the exact absolute path name of that file and then compare that file name with the particular directory that you want it to access. And so you can create a so-called jail where where that script can only access files within that particular directory. And there are loads of functions in PHP that relate to file I/O and file manipulation. Yeah. Especially if you're trying to let the user access files on your file system, then that's a crucial point where you have to make sure that everything is secure. Yeah. Okay. You can also check the bounds. That's very easy with less than minus one if you've done is numeric already. Filter var is a function in PHP that will let you filter your vars. Filter your variables. So if you can say, is this a number? Is this a positive number? It even has, is this an email address? So continuing on PHP's tradition of being a kitchen sink of sorts, filter var is a useful function for input validation. So if you say, is this an email address? It might say false, or it might say yes. So that's very simple, and it's easier than regular expressions, though. Obviously, there's more customization with regular expressions. Yep. Will it check to see if the email is valid? So the problem with email address validation is that you can never be sure that the email has actually successfully been delivered until you get a reply from the particular user. Because even if a domain is valid, you don't know if the mailbox actually exists. So one thing that people do is to actually go to the mail server and ask if this user is valid. But a mail server might say it's valid, or it might say it's invalid, even if it's not either. Okay. So you can never really be sure with email validation, but filter var gets close by doing the appropriate regular expression matching. Okay. So that's very important. And also, don't forget that get, post, and cookie are never secure. Even though it seems like you can't manipulate post variables, you'll know that it's stored in the header, right? That's one of the questions on the quiz. So get variables are transmitted in the URL, so you can imagine a user just dabbling with the URL and changing some variables. Post is exactly the same. You just need a bit more sophisticated software. Or you can just create a form of your own and then post that to someone's server. So get and post, very easy to manipulate. And cookie, it seems cookie is also hard to manipulate. But think about it. Cookies are coming from the user's browser. And the user's browser is as trustable as the user, him or herself, right? So if the user can't be trusted, then how can you trust the browser to give you the correct cookies? The cookies can always be manipulated as well. So get, post, and cookie. Don't forget about those. Always validate them, even if you think that you've already validated them. So for example, let's say we have a shopping cart tool. Let's say we have the CS50 store. And then we say, so the CS50 store... So this is a good time to advertise the store. okay, let's go to the store. So, okay. All right, you have to log in. So the CS50 store accepts credit cards and Turnbill, if you're interested. Okay, so let's say we have these the select box, size, medium. We can select from small, medium, large, extra large. And the same thing with quantity, quantity 1 to 10, right? So it seems that the only quantities that a user can select are 1 to 10, right? Is that true? No, right? A user interface-wise, yes. A user can only select values from 1 to 10, and the only ones that are listed. But just remember that this is just a form, a simple form, where if we go to if you go to the code, it's just a select box. Select name equals quantity, and then various values, 1 to 10. But a select box is just like an input box, an input text box. If I modify this code just slightly with Firebug, for example, I can simply modify the select box to be an input box and then input any arbitrary value in quantity. Even though it seems that it can only accept 1 to 10, it can accept anything, right? And then when I hit add to cart, it's going to go to add.php, and add.php will be confused because it thinks, I thought you only accepted 1 to 10. Okay? So that's a very common bug. The user interface-wise, it looks like it can only accept 1 to 10, but in the code itself, you have to, on the server side, you have to check that the bounds are correct, that every input is actually what you expected. Okay? So what add.php actually does, or I think it does, I hope, is check to see if the quantity is between 1 to 10. Okay? All right, so the same thing with size, of course. You don't want it to. So for example, there's no extra small, but a user could simply type extra small using some kind of tool or just modifying the HTML and then select extra small. But there is no extra small. Okay? So please don't try to break it. I think it's secure, but you never know. Okay. So that's it for security, and that's it for the CS50 store. Any questions about security? Any questions at all? Nope? Okay. Okay, so what if you wanted to hide the hide some code from the from other people? So if it's PHP code, then it's never going to be transmitted if the server is configured correctly to an end user, right?
Let's say you want to license it.
Oh, okay. So let's say you want to license some PHP code. You can't actually encrypt PHP code. I think so. There are some for sale PHP programs out there, and I think they come in unencrypted form based on the a good faith assumption of the user, because PHP is interpreted and it's not compiled, so you can't distribute compiled PHP code. So there's really no surefire way of encrypting PHP code. Yeah. So it's the same thing with JavaScript. If you notice, the self solution for PZ8 was encrypted, so to speak, with an encryptor. But you guys could have just copied and pasted that code into some website and then looked at the stuff solution before this preset was due. And I hope not, no one did it, but it's very simple, and I did it the day after David put it up on the website. So, see, the thing with open source and uncompiled programs in general is that you can never encrypt them. Okay? That's a good question. Any other thoughts before we move on to templating? Okay. So templating, what exactly is that? It lets you keep your logic and presentation separate. What does that mean? So XHTML and CSS is an analogy. Where XHTML just provided the semantics, the data and the formatting of the data, CSS provided the presentation details, whether a particular text was bold, whether it was colored. That was the difference between XHTML and CSS. And while it wasn't particularly clear in XHTML 1.0 transitional, the newer versions of XHTML completely got rid of say, the B tag, the bold tag, and the font tag is history, and center tag is history. All those presentational elements are now history in XHTML. So there's a clear difference between XHTML and CSS. Okay, and it's the same thing with templating. You keep your logic, your PHP code in one place, and you keep your presentation details in another place. So, for example, if you're writing some code, and if you wrote PSS 7, then all the code to generate the data, so getting it from the database and to actually copying to pasting that into the web browser, all that code was the same file, right? It was in the same PHP file, and it looked rather messy because you had all those begin PHP and end PHP blocks in your code. So that was rather messy, and it also prevented good management of your layout. So, for example, if you wanted to completely redesign your website, you had to go through each PHP page and change those manually. But with templating, you can separate the logic and the presentation details in your code, and so you can change one without changing the other. Okay. So, and it also helps if you have one web programmer working on one project and one web designer working on a project. So if a web designer doesn't know PHP, and if the web programmer doesn't really know much about web design, then the two can still work together by editing the different files. Okay. So let's see. And also a bonus about templating is that it caches constant data for you. So for example, if you always have welcome to my foo website on at the top of your website, then if that doesn't always change, then it'll cache that for you, so it doesn't need to be regenerated every time. Okay, so a particular templating solution here is called Smarty, and it's available for free, smarty.net. And there are three basic steps. I won't actually show the real code here because there's a very good quick install guide on the website, which will guide you in like 5 minutes to creating your first Smarty-based program. But there are three basic steps. You first initialize the Smarty engine. That's very simple, just some constructor code. And then you initialize the variable. So you say, for example, if you want to say, so for example, if the site name was foo website, then you can say Smarty assign title foo website. So it'll assign the title. It'll initialize all those variables in the template to a particular variable. And then we simply display the template. And the template comes in a .tpl file. And it looks like an HTML file, except it has weird curly braces where the variable should be. So I'll show you an example. This is actually from my own CS50 final project from last year, crimsondining.org, which I've shamelessly plugged in some walkthrough. So I have the lunch menu. This is today's lunch menu from HUDS, and it's reading all this data from a database. And we have some, so you can see the stars here are presentational details, and the titles here are all presentational details. So what I've done is I've effectively separated the presentation and the logic in the code, and you can't really see that from here. But if you go to Facebook and hope it still works, you can see here that the same, well, this is the dinner menu now that lunch is over. So you can see here that the same data is displayed in two different formats. And it may seem that I've written the PHP code to read the data from the database twice, but I've actually only written the PHP code once, and I've written two templates for it. So that's a very nice way of using templates. So if you have both a Facebook application and a PHP website, like here, then you can use the same code twice. If you didn't have templates, then you'd have to write the PHP code twice, right? You'd have to have two copies of the same PHP file that had different presentational elements. But here I've integrated those two into one PHP code by using templates. And I'll show you the code for this front page, part of the front page. Let's see. Okay, so this is the PHP code that generates it. It's very simple. Has a SQL query, it selects some rows from a column, from a table, and then it says if result equals MySQL query, we're all used to that now, and it creates a new array with each of the dish elements as rows in that array, and then it says Smarty, which is the Smarty object, as you'll see in the quick install guide or any reference to Smarty, and then assigns the dishes to dishes. So it's saying the $dishes array, the dishes array, should be put into this dishes variable in the template. Okay? So on the template side, this is the PHP file. And in the template file, the TPL file, I have just some random HTML, except with these smarty curly brace blocks. So if is set dishes, if dishes has been set, you can see here that you can use functions that look very similar to PHP. So is set is a function in PHP, and smarty also has is set. So I'm saying for each from dishes item dish, that's saying for each dishes as dish in PHP, that's saying go through each of the dishes, assigning the variable name dish to each dish, say $dish.dishid, so get the dish ID, get the dish name, and you can see here one nice feature of Smarty where you can say HTML special chars inside a brace and then make it encode it appropriately. And I'm using this here in case HUDs XSSs me by putting some script tags in there in their dish names on their website. They haven't done that so far, but even if they do, I'm covered because I have HTML special chars. And then I have this. I created a function called stars, which generates those stars, and I specify the rating by saying dish rating. And then if there's no food, then I say else no food is available at HUDs at this time. So you can see here that even though I've separated most of the low-level database stuff from the PHP code, I can still have these if, else, and for each elements in my template. But can you see here how I can... So this is the website code, and the Facebook web application code is very similar. It just has a slightly different presentational element to it. But I still use the same PHP file. Yeah. Any questions about Smarty and what it can do? There's a wealth of documentation on the Smarty website. And there's the quick install guide. The older documentation is available, and it'll tell you how to use HTML special chars in the way I did. It'll tell you how to use for each and stuff like that. And there's also a nice example as well. Any questions about templating and why you might use it or why you might not use it? So I'd highly recommend looking into it, at least, because it'll save a lot of headaches later when you're trying to update your website. And if you only create a website now, but you want to integrate it into Facebook later, then you might be able to use the same PHP code. Any questions about Smarty? Or is anyone going to use it now that they've heard about it? You are? Chris? You are? Yeah? Yeah. Definitely take a look at it anyway. Any questions about anything that we've covered so far? No? You guys are awfully quiet. Okay, so the real world. Never assume that all the data that's coming in from the internet is secure. Never assume that you'll have the same number of users you had today will come back tomorrow. Let's hope they do. But never assume that there's not a very popular website that links to you suddenly and then sends users flooding to your website one day, and you might wake up with your website totally down and trashed. Okay, and always doubt that your user will provide particular variables. Always doubt that the user is nice. Make sure that you're checking your input variables and doing the appropriate escaping and HTML special charring. And then, of course, have fun. That is, unless hackers come in and take down your website at 4 a.m. in the morning. So that's it for a PHP real world seminar. And if you have any questions, I'll stick around. And you can also email me as well if you have any questions. All right, so that's the end. Thank you.